Council, can I just confirm, can you both hear me?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, great. Mr. Katsuyama, you may proceed.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, Neil Katsuyama for the appellant, Brusco Tug and Barge. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if possible. Okay. Your Honors, I'd like to start with a point that I think was not emphasized very heavily in the briefs. Certainly one of the key issues in this case is whether the employer should have compelled the employee's compliance with a Section 301 petition. I think to answer that question, Your Honor, the parties need to look at one of the sections 2502 in both of the collective bargaining agreements. Your Honor, I'm going to just quote from it briefly. It says, except as elsewhere provided in the article, any dispute that is not reduced to writing and presented to the employer within 30 days after the facts became known to the union or the aggrieved employee shall be deemed waived.
May I ask, before you get into the details of the agreement, I don't think either party has raised this question, but I wonder if you could address the sort of threshold question of why the Federal Arbitration Act applies here at all, given that Section 1 says it doesn't apply to contracts of employment of seamen, railroad employees, or other classes of workers engaged in foreign or interstate commerce. And this is a worker on a vessel. It seems like you would be covered by that. Did you have a view on that question?
Your Honor, I had not looked at that in a great deal before today. I do recall, I think the brief just emphasized the fact that Brusco Tug and Barge does engage in interstate commerce. I believe it has some does a lot of work in Washington State, among other things. So I recall from the briefing that was the crux of where we tried to invoke the Federal Arbitration Act, Your Honor.
But this contract specifically applies to workers that are in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Yes.
So to echo Judge Miller's comments, I'm a little bit confused as to why the parties would think that the FAA would apply given the express exemption under Section 1. And that may not ultimately make that much of a difference in this case, but just wanted to get your reaction to that.
Sure, Your Honors, I don't have much to add beyond, I guess, what I mentioned on the interstate commerce issue. I do believe, though, whether it's read under the California Arbitration Act or Federal Arbitration Act, the plain text of the terms and the interpretation of the grievance procedure, I'm not sure would be affected substantially under either statutory regime, Your Honors.
So I guess my question then would be, before we get into issues of waiver or forfeiture or other things, does the arbitration agreement provide for arbitration between Mr. Miles and Brusco Tug and Barge?
Right, Your Honor, I guess it seems you're speaking to the broader question. I mean, certainly if Mr. Miles is acknowledging himself as a member of the union and that they're able to negotiate on his behalf, and that certainly the employer is bound by these terms, well, I think it stands to reason. Mr. Miles is allowed to sort of delegate his right to negotiate terms of employment to a union. So, correct, even though he may not individually be signing or particularly named in this agreement exactly, he would still be bound by it.
As I read the dispute resolution provisions, it seems to speak primarily to a process between the union and the employer, that the grievance process gets initiated by someone from the union, a steward or an authorized union representative. The employer has to respond in writing. And if that process doesn't resolve the issue, then the union or the employer can demand arbitration. None of this language seems to indicate that the employee, that Mr. Miles, could ever ask for arbitration, or two, that he would be compelled to participate in arbitration if the union never filed a grievance. So as a threshold question, do we even have an agreement to arbitrate between the parties?
Well, Your Honor, I think that I was trying to get at by pointing out to the 2502 section, which essentially says if they have not participated in the grievance procedure, if they have not sent something right to the employer, they've waived it. So I think that's a threshold issue the plaintiff needs to overcome as to why it wasn't waived at the outset.
Let me just follow up. If it says in 25.10, failure of the union to comply, if there's any failure by the union or the employees to comply with any of the time requirements, then the agreement is canceled.
Yes, Your Honor.
It shall constitute a material breach of this agreement and shall then cancel this agreement until the dispute has been settled. So if no grievance was ever initiated and the agreement is then canceled, how can there be a requirement to arbitrate something that's been canceled?
Well, and Your Honor, I think this relates to kind of the bigger point as to that section is also, there's a tension, I think it contradicts the argument plaintiff's making about we should file a Section 301 petition. I think if the consequences of noncompliance are already addressed in the agreement itself, both the waiver provision and the 2510 section Your Honor pointed out, then I think invoking a 301 petition doesn't, essentially why file a 301 petition, Your Honor, if the agreement already covers or already contemplates what happens in the events of noncompliance. And I think that's a key distinction with the Knutson case that plaintiff's briefs relied upon heavily.
But setting aside 301, if you don't have an agreement to arbitrate between Mr. Miles and your client, then that's the end of the deal, isn't it? There's no, you can't enforce an agreement to arbitrate when none exists.
Well, Your Honor, I guess I would just go back to my earlier point, which is that clearly the union was negotiating on behalf of plaintiff. Certainly it's negotiating in the shoes of or on behalf of many of these workers. And so I think if they're not bound by it, Your Honor, then we have a great many problems because this agreement
What would be your best case for the proposition that an arbitration agreement that binds the union and the employer also binds an employee to arbitration? What authority would you rely on in support of that point?
I guess I can't set a case off the top of my head, Your Honor, but certainly just the notion that I thought there was no dispute between the employer-employee, that they are both bound on ways to for compensation, for vacation time, for all kinds of rights that they may have in this employment relationship. It would be strange, I suppose, Your Honor, if that dictates the employer-employee relationship in basically all other regards, and yet in the one area of arbitration for that to be null and void would seem to contradict the point of a union negotiation. And the whole point is that they're on behalf of workers, Your Honor.
You mentioned Knutson, right? So
yes, Your Honor.
Knutson versus KTLE seems to, it's a state appellate decision. And I understand that this was under the Section 301 of the Labor Management Relations Act, but the court there found that because there had not been an express agreement to arbitrate any disputes between an employee and the employer, there was no agreement to arbitrate by the employee or binding the employee, because that collective bargaining agreement expressly stated that only the union and the defendant may require arbitration of other party. And it didn't grant a union member the power to compel an employee to arbitrate. So that's where my questioning is getting at. If Knutson suggests that there's not an agreement to arbitrate between an employee when the collective bargaining agreement is framed as union and employer only, where's your authority to bind Mr. Miles here?
Right, Your Honor. I guess in the Knutson case, I would just point out that the steps one and two do talk about the employee having the right to start the grievance process. I acknowledge that the employee is not specifically named in the later steps, but the fact that it is mentioned, the employee is identified in steps one and two, seems to imply at least that they must have some role in step three, which is the arbitration clause, Your Honor.
But that's not here, right? There's
yes, Your Honor.
As the initial step, it shall be presented in writing to the employer by the steward or an authorized union representative. So there's no, the initiation of the grievance process does not come from the employee. It still comes from the union or a union rep.
Which, again, Your Honor, I think this goes to the tension of plaintiff's position of asking us to do a 301 petition to compel the plaintiff. I think exactly what you're saying, it's what exactly would be compelling plaintiff to do in an agreement where the individual employee is not identified or named in the, I think it's the Section 25 dispute resolution portions.
Do you understand Mr. Miles to have presented an argument that he is not bound by the CBA? And that its arbitration clause just doesn't apply to him?
Not that I recall, Your Honor. Although, yes, not that I recall having reviewed the briefs lately, Your Honor. If I could just highlight one of the differences with the Knutson case, The footnote one in that case explains, going back to the waiver, that the waiver in that one says if the grievance is not presented in writing in 60 days, then the violation shall not be processed under or be subject to this procedure. I think that's a key distinction from the agreement here, which calls for the waiver if the plaintiff or union does not comply with the written grievance procedure. So I'd just like to highlight that distinction as well as to why the Section 301 argument doesn't make sense in this agreement compared to the Knudsen case.
And could you address the rule of you know, right against Universal Maritime Service, and I think there's a California equivalent, that in order to arbitrate a statutory claim, there has to be some, you know, clear and unmistakable agreement. And here we have a clause that doesn't say anything about statutory claims. So why should we read it to apply to Miles's California statutory claims?
Right, Your Honor, I don't... I may have to concede that point, Your Honor. I'm not seeing the list of statutory claims specifically listed, at least in the 2009 agreement.
Did you? Yeah, I think you... Oh.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Your Honor.
I was just noting that I think you wanted to reserve some time. You can keep
yes,
going
Your Honor,
you want,
unless you have further questions.
Okay.
Okay.
You may. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Bagakis?
Yes, good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Christina Bagakis, and I represent Frank Miles, a plaintiff and appellee in this matter. Frank Miles filed a complaint in 2018 against his former employer, Brusco Tug and Barge, alleging statutory violations of the California Labor Code. 2 years later, Brusco filed a motion to compel arbitration based on a provision within a collective bargaining agreement between Brusco and the International Organization of Masters, Mates, and Pilots Pacific Maritime Region, the union to which Mr. Miles belonged during the course of his employment with Brusco. The lower court properly denied the motion to compel arbitration for three reasons. First, as the lower court directly recognized in its order, Brusco forfeited its right to compel arbitration by failing to follow the grievance procedure identified in the arbitration provision of the CBA. Second, Brusco acted inconsistent with the intent to enforce an arbitration agreement for 2 years and in direct opposition to the fundamental purpose behind arbitration. Third, and although not addressed by the lower court, the arbitration provision of the CBA does not apply to Frank Miles's claims because the general language does not include a clear and unmistakable waiver of Mr. Miles's right to a judicial forum to bring his statutory claims under the California Labor Code. Turning to my first point, the court correctly applied the Knudsen v. KTLA ruling in its determination that Brusco forfeited the right to compel arbitration when it failed to enforce any other steps identified in the grievance procedure within the CBA. In its opening brief...
Can I ask? I'm a little confused. Is there a Section 301 claim issue in this case? In other words, Knudsen related to a claim of trying to seek enforcement of dispute resolution procedures under the Labor Management Relations Act. Is there that type of issue in this case as well?
I believe so, Your Honor.
How so? As I understand it, he was filing suit in state court under wage and hour claims and business and professions code, and
yes.
And defendant is trying to move to arbitrate those claims. Where's the Section 301 issue coming up, if you can enlighten me?
It's my understanding that that's just a contention by the defendant, and it's something that we don't believe applies, but it's an argument that we're making against defendant's contention that there is a 301 issue.
Okay. And do you have a view as to whether the collective bargaining agreement, which discusses the union and the employer and a grievance process and arbitration between those two parties, whether that binds an employee like Mr. Miles?
So in connection with these claims, we do not believe it binds the employee. Again, as Your Honor mentioned, it does not include a clear and unmistakable waiver of his ability to bring these statutory claims to a judicial forum.
But that's because of the special rule for statutory claims. You're not making the more general argument that it only applies as between the union and the employer, and it doesn't apply to a member of the union, are you?
Not specifically, although it is a point that we address, that is identified in appellant's brief, that the only way to enforce this grievance procedure was through the union.
And I guess sort of continuing in the theme of issues that maybe haven't been discussed very much. Do you have a view on Section 1 of the FAA and whether the FAA applies here at all?
It did not address that in our briefing, and it wasn't raised in the lower court's decision, so I do not at this time.
Okay.
I guess I have a more clarifying question. Maybe that is somewhere in the record that I just didn't find. Is there something in the record indicating whether or not Mr. Miles is considered a seaman?
I don't believe so, although he is specifically named in the CBA.
All right, thank you.
Didn't I see something in the record that he works as a deck engineer and he's responsible for the machinery and maintenance of the vessels?
Yes, that is correct.
So that would make him a seaman, wouldn't it, if that were the case?
And that was my question. That was my question, because I did read that, but I wasn't clear that the record indicating whether he just works there when they're docked or whether when they were at sea. That was not clear on the record.
That is something that I'm happy to provide additional briefing on, but I do not have an answer at this time.
True. Thank you, counsel.
Okay. As we were discussing, appellant acknowledges in its brief at page 24 that Frank Miles was incapable of initiating the grievance arbitration process, and that because he left his employment with Brusco at the time of his claims, quote, there was no mechanism to force Miles to first provide Brusco with the complaint in writing, for Brusco to reply, and or for the union to review and discuss the resolution of the claims, end quote. Miles did, however, provide Brusco with written notice of his claims, both before his complaint was filed in the form of a demand letter in December 2017, and then again when the complaint was served on Brusco in 2018. Based on the inability for Miles to participate in the grievance procedure as drafted, Brusco further acknowledges that, quote, any action to enforce the agreement under Section 301 would therefore have had to be filed against the union and not Miles. Appellant therefore acknowledges in its brief that the provision relied upon to compel arbitration in its initial motion must be filed against the union, not Miles. Despite such, whether the employee was identified in step one of the grievance process as in Knutson does not change the fact that Brusco failed to enforce the remaining steps 1 through 3 in the grievance process as analyzed by the Knutson court and the Honorable Troy Nunley in his decision to deny Brusco's motion to compel arbitration. Turning to my second point, Brusco failed to act consistent with the intent to arbitrate and engaged in dilatory procedural tactics which contradict the fundamental purpose of arbitration. The Ninth Circuit in Van Ness Townhouses v. Mar Industries Corp. found that a party's extended silence and delay in moving for arbitration may indicate a conscious decision to continue to seek judicial judgment on the merits of the arbitrable claims, which would be inconsistent with the right to arbitrate. Here,
Weren't the parties waiting for the court to rule on the motion to remand? Wasn't that the bulk of the delay that was occasioned here?
Yes, and that is the reasoning used by the defendant. But a motion to remand does not stay any proceedings. There was no motion to stay proceedings filed by either party, which would have prevented Brusco from filing a motion to compel arbitration.
But how would Brusco know which court to file its motion for arbitration with until that issue had been resolved? Because suppose the district court decides to remand it, wouldn't Brusco then need to file it in state court instead of federal court?
Sure, but Brusco filed the removal with the understanding that the federal court had jurisdiction, while plaintiff filed a motion to remand that didn't change Brusco's beliefs that the federal court had jurisdiction over the matter. They could have filed a motion to compel arbitration, and the two motions could have been decided concurrently. They chose not to file anything or raise the arbitration agreement at all for nearly 2 years until after the motion to remand was decided, and even 3 months past that time.
So you're not arguing that they were dilatory because of the three-month delay from the ruling? It was that they should have filed something concurrently with the motion to remand?
Or at any point before that. Again, they received initial notice of plaintiff's or Frank Miles' claims in writing in December 2017 prior to filing his complaint in state court. At that point, as one of the two signatories on the collective bargaining agreement, neither of whom were Frank Miles, Brusco could have involved the union to enforce each step of the grievance process. They did not do so.
And when what was actually happening while the motion to remand was pending?
Nothing was happening.
Okay, so how, I mean, I understand the argument of, you know, waiver through, you know, actual, you know, litigation conduct where you're, you know, taking depositions or, you know, doing things that would be inconsistent with going to arbitration. But if nothing's happening, you know, how are you prejudiced by the delay in filing the motion?
Well, at this point, we have engaged in extensive motion practice. We have been prevented from conducting
any discovery, during the year, during the year when the motion to remand was pending, and nothing's happening. Like, yes. If I guess my question is, how would it be? How would anyone have been better off if they had, you know, filed the motion to compel arbitration, and it was also just sitting there with nothing happening on it for a year? It doesn't seem like that would have made any difference.
Right. Again, there was no stay of proceedings at this time.
As a practical matter, I think you just said there are not actually any proceedings to stay, right? It's just, everything's just sitting there waiting for a ruling.
Correct. But that doesn't change the fact that they contended that the federal court had jurisdiction over the case. They could have compelled, they could have served discovery at this time, even though, you know, we contended that there was no jurisdiction, it should have been in state court. They just did nothing. And again, going back to the case Van Ness Townhouses v. Mart Industries Corp., the extended silence and delays in moving to compel arbitration is inconsistent with the right to arbitrate.
But that case didn't that case didn't involve a pending court ruling, did it?
Right, but at any point when plaintiff's complaint was filed September 2018, when they filed an answer in 2018, in October 25th, 2018, when they removed it October 26th, 2018, at any of these points, they could have filed a motion to compel arbitration. Even after a motion to remand is filed, that doesn't prevent them from filing a motion to compel arbitration. And then it was only, you know, in March 9th, 2020, 2 years after this complaint is filed, did they suddenly reach out and say, hey, we have this arbitration provision that we've had in our possession since 2017 before litigation even commenced. And that is a significant delay on their part, and it has prejudiced my client and his ability to resolve his claims, obtain discovery in a case that's now 5 years old. And it again directly contradicts the fundamental purpose of arbitration. Arbitration is meant to be a streamlined procedure for simple, quick, and efficient method to resolve these types of controversies. They waited roughly 842 days from its initial notice of plaintiff's claims to seek to compel an arbitration provision that's been known to Brusco and its counsel from the outset of litigation. It's caused, again, significant motion practice. It's a clear, purposeful delay to all proceedings. And it, again, goes against the fundamental purpose of arbitration. And turning to my final point quickly, appellant cites to 14 Penn Plaza LLC v. Pyatt to argue that federal law requires employees covered by a collective bargaining agreement to arbitrate any disputes. Again, this misstates the findings of the court. The Supreme Court held that an agreement to arbitrate statutory anti-discrimination claims must be explicitly stated in the CBA. It is not explicitly stated in this arbitration provision that Mr. Miles's statutory California Labor Code claims would be covered by the CBA. And for these reasons, Frank Miles respectfully requests this court affirm the ruling of the lower court denying appellant's motion to compel arbitration and allow this case to proceed to trial in accordance with the decision of the trial court. I would be happy to answer any additional questions that the panel may have, but if not, I will yield the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Bagakis. Mr. Katsuyama, you have, I think, about 4 minutes left.
Yes, Your Honor. If I could just briefly address some of the questions I think were pending.
Mr. Katsuyama, one question I do have, which was her last point, Ms. Bagakis' last point, which is what in the CBA indicates that there is a clear and unmistakable waiver to bring statutory claims? Can you point to that for me? What section specifically?
Right, Your Honor, I think the best section we have is 1704, the coverage of dispute. I don't argue or deny that the specific statutes are not listed in that, but that is the section that the defendant relied upon.
So you concede that point?
Your Honor, yes, I don't see elsewhere in the CBA at the moment where other statutes are specifically identified.
All right, thank you.
Your Honor, I want to answer one question. There's a question about whether Miles would be subject to the CBAs. I just wanted to point out on section 15.01, Mr. Miles is specifically named in the CBA. This is on page 115 of docket entry 7. In fact, it actually has a provision that Mr. Miles and two other employees were guaranteed 80 hours of work per month. So there is a specific provision and also specific guarantees that are provided for Mr. Miles. I think certainly can't have his cake and eat it too. He needs to either acknowledge that he's entitled to some guarantees in this agreement and that he's a party to it, but I think he can have it both ways and try and pretend he's not subject to the arbitration clauses in the CBA.
So you're, if I understand correctly, because he gets some benefits in the contract, he is necessarily included in the arbitration agreement, regardless of what the arbitration agreement might say itself?
Well, Your Honor, I think this is on top of what the point I was making earlier, which is I don't think it's disputed that the union was representing and acting on behalf of all these employees. And in addition to the fact that the union is acting in that capacity, Mr. Miles is also individually named. And I think taken together, I think it would be difficult for Mr. Miles to say the union was not negotiating on his behalf or that he wasn't specifically being the subject of this union agreement, Mr. Miles.
I guess what I would grant you is this, that it seems like the collective bargaining agreement indicates that if a grievance is not resolved, either the employer or the union can demand arbitration. And in that arbitration, an employee has to participate then, right? That's in 25.03, I think. But the novel question is, you know, where there's been no grievance process initiated, at least, or no ability by the employee to initiate it, does that then bind the employee in an arbitration agreement that never advanced through the grievance process? I think that seems to be the issue that's at play, or one of the issues that's at play in this case.
I agree, Your Honor, and I think that's one of the key issues. You know, we're talking about waiver and forfeiture, and really the question is, who had the duty to act? You know, plaintiff's been taking the position it was employer's duty to act by filing a 301 petition. I think Your Honor stated our position, which is that either the plaintiff or the union, the ball was in their court, so to speak, which is to initiate grievance. Or, as I mentioned, 2502 says they waive it. So that's even more reason why the employer is not under any duty at all. In fact, the 2502 provision suggests they not do anything, because if the union does not take prompt action the claims are waived. So it seems reasonably, how can they relinquish a right when the contract expressly provides for a waiver based on the delay of the plaintiff or the union?
I understand.
Okay. The only other point I want to make, Your Honor, the demand letter, plaintiff's counsel referenced to December 2017. I just want to highlight that is more than 30 days after the alleged aggrieved events occurred. So if we are looking at 2502, that is outside the time when they're supposed to have submitted a written grievance, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. We thank both counsel, and the case is submitted.